Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The stories about people who are mentally ill, struggling to cope, often with their families at their sides, are common. Sometimes that's not enough. Last week we heard that the suspect in the downtown stabbings, John Mallett, is mentally ill and off his medication. His father told the dispatch that they had tried to get help from the courts and mental health system, but were told they couldn't be helped until John Mallett did something. Last week, he did. And now, his father says, it's too late. Coming up later, we'll hear from one of the attorneys who defended Charles A. McCoy Jr., the so-called highway shooter from 2003, who also suffered from severe mental illness and whose family also struggled to help him. We'll also hear from a journalist who wrote a book about his journey getting help for his adult son diagnosed with bipolar disorder and his investigative research at the psychiatric ward of a county jail in Florida. Joining us now is psychiatrist Dr. Michael Unger. He's the medical director at Concord Counseling Services in Westerville. Dr. Unger is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at OSU. He was the medical director of Southeast Inc. Mental Health Services, and he is a former president of the Psychiatric Society of Central Ohio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Unger.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also joining us now is Marcia Knapp. She's the mother of Adam Knapp. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he died at the age of 30 after causing a fatal car accident, killing another driver. We'll hear how Marcia and her husband have struggled for years to get help for their adult son. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
Thank you.
Question for our listeners. If you have a child, sibling, or other relative struggling with mental illness, tell us your story. Have you been able to find adequate support and services from the mental health system? How has it worked for you? Dr. Unger, we've read interviews with the family members of John Mallett, the suspect in the stabbings last week downtown. His father in Brooklyn said that John had been having years of problems. He was always thinking that people are out to get him, so he always wanted to harm himself. His aunt in Columbus, with whom he lived or stayed sometimes, said the mental health system in Nashville put him on a bus to Columbus when she agreed to take him in. She says he ran out of his medications for schizophrenia, and they tried to get them refilled by phone because he wouldn't set foot in a clinic despite her urging. These are all such basic issues that we're, that apparently we're still grappling with.
Right. Yeah, it's if you have chest pain and someone diagnoses you with, you know, some type of heart condition, you know, it's easier to kind of get it and realize that something's wrong and you need to stay on your medications, and you have the insight that something's wrong, and the trigger is the chest pain that sends a clear signal to your brain that says, I better get some help, because everybody knows what chest pain could be, and everybody knows what a heart attack is probably before they're 10. And I think it's hard with mental illness because the part of the brain that actually fails is the part of the brain that signals to you, like the heart or the chest pain would. It's the part of the brain that says, this is wrong, my thinking is confused, I'm really paranoid, I have an abnormal level of paranoia compared with most people, and I feel very troubled by this, and it's dictating my behavior, and it's beginning to impact my ability to function normally in life. So that level of insight itself is missing.
And go ahead.
And as a result of that, often people with this chronic lifelong illness don't stay on medications. Sometimes even when the medications are available to them, they don't, you know. So it's very tough because of the level of insight from the person has that they suffer from that lack of awareness of the condition and the severity of it.
And one of our problems these days is that we don't have the long-term care facility. So if the sort of illness that someone is suffering from requires long-term, not just care, but observation to make a better assessment, that's really not as available as it used to be.
You are so right. And I trained in New York City, and our average length of stay in the hospitals there was 2 to 3 months. And then when I was at my first job out of residency was here in Ohio, and I went from that system to all of a sudden saying, you know, you have 3.5 days to discharge this person, to do the complete workup, you know, maximum 5 days, you know. And it was just a real paradigm shift. Like, you have to kind of get, quote unquote, get this person well again in 5 days, you know. And it's a lot of pressure, and it's a model that doesn't really work.
Well, it defies logic.
Right.
It came along with the deinstitutionalization at the same time as this new generation of psychotropic drugs that were considered so effective. There's a lot of reliance on psychotropic drugs for good reason. A lot of them actually, they do work. But is there too much? Is there a blurred line there, or have we just put too much faith in them?
Well, I think that the medications are largely very effective, but the emphasis on prescribing only is very, very, it's overemphasized. I think that the relationship that you develop with a person, with your patient is so important. For example, I just saw a woman that had been homeless in Columbus, Ohio for many years. Kind of as we would say, living off the grid because her whereabouts was unknown. She didn't have any access to any family members. She didn't really feel sad about that because often someone with severe and persistent mental illness, it's kind of, in her case, kind of like a bag woman, you know, walking downtown and mumbling to herself as she would just ambulate down the... if she knew how sick she was, she'd be horribly depressed. But she wasn't. And she wasn't a danger to herself or anyone else, so she wasn't even linked. And then when she was linked, you know, she gradually, after a few years, got some housing and lives in a, community housing network facility. And, I just saw her, spent a half hour with her up here in Westerville. She's doing really well on her medications, and she takes it every day. Now, if I tell her... explain why you're taking an antipsychotic. She wouldn't even be able to tell me that at all. She wouldn't be able to, if I said, what's your diagnosis? She actually wouldn't be able to explain that she has schizophrenia. But she's actually doing really well. She's functioning every day. She's happy. She doesn't have any depression. She eats, she shops for her own food. She's clean. Her clothes are, she was wearing a nice outfit today. She's taking the medication because of, I actually did some site visits and actually went to the residence and saw the clients there and developed a rapport with the people that have the illnesses in their office, which is their apartments in their home. So, that's a different type of kind of position, different type of emphasis on the relationship you have with the patients. And then you can always go the brain chemistry route and prescribe medications, but it's really establishing trust. You know, she doesn't know me from Adam, and she's taking this medication now. She takes it every day. She's doing fantastic.
It's a very holistic approach is what you're talking about. And one of the problems is what we are talking about are adults with mental illness. And Marcia Knapp, that for you posed when if your son had been 12 years old and going through the same kinds of problems, it wouldn't have created you wouldn't have had the same kind of barriers that you faced as a family member of an adult person who's mentally ill.
Yes, that is very true, because we could not tell the hospital what my son needed because he was an adult, and we didn't even have the opportunity to speak to doctors until they released him.
Dr. Unger, what about that? That just, again, once again, if I say it once, I'll probably say it 10 more times this hour. It defies logic.
Yes. Defying logic is something that's unfortunately becoming more and more prevalent in some of the ways things work. I'll tell you, it's very different. In New York State, if someone with severe and persistent mental illness is hospitalized twice involuntarily as a result of going off of their psychiatric medications for severe mental illness like schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, if they have two involuntary hospitalizations within 18 months, you can petition to have them on outpatient commitment, which also, the bad side. It takes away their rights. The good side keeps them out of the hospital, and you can put them on medication, and it works. And so the outpatient commitment laws in New York are different, and there's some teeth behind them where if a person is, say, missing in action or say, is, you know, in one city or another city and, you know, is lost to follow-up, you can actually bring them into the emergency room and give them, say, a monthly injection of an antipsychotic and send them on their way. And that keeps them out of the hospital to some degree. You know, obviously that's not the best system in the world, but in Ohio, there are things such as outpatient commitment, which is kind of a loose, it's not a clear path, and it doesn't have anything to do normally with, you can force someone into treatment, but not on medications. And so if they have outpatient commitment, but they don't have like a forced medication order, they don't need to take the medication, their insight's lacking, and then they could still, you know, get into trouble. So it's definitely very difficult.
Marcia Knapp, you were nodding. It's the familiar memory for you.
Yeah, definitely.
With your son, Adam.
He just did not want to stay on the medication. He didn't like the side effects. And so he would try to go off, and he could do well for several months, unbeknown to us. But then he would just crash, and then mm-hmm. it would be very extreme.
When I, Dr. Unger, I know you have to take off pretty soon, but when I read the article about Adam Knapp by Bloomberg, they mentioned that they would bring him to the hospital and they would observe him, and he would seem fine, and the physician on duty would say, well, he seems fine, you know, we can't keep him. Isn't this the psychiatric community, don't they know more than anybody else how that works?
Yeah, the problem is the right of the person to refuse care is usually, the priority for someone, because we as psychiatrists, you know, we don't want to lock someone up, you know, temporarily for 5 to 7 days or whatever. You know, against their will, it's certainly not a good thing to do, mm-hmm. And certainly doesn't make us feel good. So that the threshold for admission, because of funding, because of length of stay, because of shortness of hospital beds and everything, it actually affects the threshold at which you say, okay, you have to be in the hospital. If the hospitals were empty, and there were empty psychiatric beds, and someone said, you know, this person really needs help, I have a feeling that the threshold for admitting that person would be lower, and they'd have a better chance of getting into the hospital. But if things are almost always operating above or at capacity, the threshold becomes two things: suicidal thoughts or homicidal or violent thoughts or behavior, severe agitation, things like that. Mm-hmm. It could be something like somebody's disorganized, they're agitated, they're running down High Street in Columbus, shouting at, you know, CODA buses and stuff like that, putting themselves and possibly others at risk. That would also meet the criteria to admit them against their will. Okay? And it's not always so clear-cut. And sometimes someone can have delusions, or they can have auditory hallucinations that are telling them to do things, but the nature of those secret, in quotation marks, secret symptoms that they're having is kept to them. You know, they won't disclose they're having those symptoms, or they're intermittent, and while they're in the emergency room, maybe they're not having those symptoms. Maybe the voices might even be telling them, don't trust these people. Mm-hmm. Don't trust these people. And that's, you know, from 15 years of treating these conditions, and getting to know the people I work with really well, you know, when they're well, they can tell you exactly, sometimes in retrospect, what they were thinking. So you learn a lot from that.
Dr. Unger, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Can I just leave you with a couple ideas?
Yes.
Family struggle. I have a personal, I have a brother that has struggled with similar situations, and in another state in the West, and getting him help took about a decade, even with me being a psychiatrist and calling other places. So I'm not immune, and nor is anyone else. But we do have some good news. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, mm-hmm. capital N-A-M-I. That's a great organization. It's free. They have NAMI meetings for family members. They actually have it's throughout the entire country, but Franklin County in Ohio here has a NAMI, a very, very active NAMI. There's a NAMI walk in the spring that actually, it's a fundraiser for NAMI. But they have meetings. They have tons of free information about mental illness. They have a schizophrenia anonymous meetings. It's actually led by people that have mental illness but are doing extremely well and have for a long time, and their insights improved. And that's a fantastic organization. And knowledge and awareness is really key. And I just wanted to say that because it's a free thing. It's yeah. out there. There's tons of information. Parents, siblings, there's actually meetings for them, how to deal with these difficult issues, support groups. And then you can kind of share, you know, your stories and get ideas from other people, how to reach people that are difficult to reach when it comes to the level of their insight.
We will post a link to NAMI on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Once again, Dr. Unger, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Okay.
Dr. Michael Unger, he is the medical director at Concord Counseling Services. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Marcia Knapp, and we'll be joined by Pete Early, a journalist and mental health advocate. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook, coming up on the next On Point, hate crimes, charges, suicide, and subtleties in the case of a gay student at Rutgers. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 67 degrees with partly sunny skies in downtown Columbus. There is a 30% chance of a thunderstorm this afternoon. Otherwise, sunshine and a high near 80 degrees. A slight chance of showers for tonight, a low of 59 degrees. Mostly sunny for Tuesday and a high of 81. Partly cloudy Tuesday night, a low of 58.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the struggles of mentally ill adults and their families to cope with the current mental health care system. We heard that John Mallett, the suspect in the downtown stabbings last week, is mentally ill and was off his medication. His father and his aunt said he tried to get help, but now it's too late. Also with us now is Marcia Knapp. She's the mother of Adam Knapp. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He died at the age of 30 after not being properly medicated and by causing a fatal car accident. Welcome back, Marcia.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joining us now is journalist and mental health advocate Pete Early. Pete is the author of 13 books, including the 2007 Pulitzer Prize finalist, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. It was about his journey to get help for his adult son who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Welcome to the show, Pete.
Thanks for having me on.
I thought it was kind of funny when I was reading about your book that a lot of people were offended by the title of the book, Crazy. They misunderstood what you were trying to say. You're
That's
saying
right.
that the system is crazy.
I absolutely discovered that. You know, I was a Washington Post reporter. I thought I knew a lot about mental illness. And then my own son got sick, and I could not get him help. And he ended up getting arrested.
As your son was moving through the mental health system and the law enforcement system, you began an investigation of daily life at in the psychiatric ward of the Miami-Dade County Jail. You were granted complete access, which is amazing, to that psychiatric unit on the ninth floor of the jail. It was sometimes called the forgotten floor. What did you find there?
Well, and I wanted to go into a jail, and I tried to get into the Los Angeles County Jail because it is, believe it or not, the largest public mental facility in the United States. One of the things you have to realize is in Ohio today, a recent study showed that there is a 4-to-1 chance if you have a mental illness, you're going to end up in jail rather than getting treatment. 4-to-1. Now, imagine if that statistic was about heart attacks. 4-to-1, you'd end up in jail instead of getting help. I went to the Miami-Dade jail because it was the only one that would let me in, and I followed people who were clearly psychotic out onto the streets to see what happened. And what you discovered is that 16% of people in jails and prisons today are people who used to be in state hospitals, who are there because they're sick, not because they're criminals. I saw men drinking out of toilets, men locked in cells built for two that had 5 or 6 people in it, completely naked, people not getting any kind of psychiatric care. In fact, it was barbaric, and these people would leave for 2 or 3 days and then be picked up on the street and brought back. And I've been to Ohio several times, and I can tell you that same thing is happening in your state. People who are called frequent flyers, who are ill, who are psychotic, but because they're not dangerous, and it's very difficult to judge that, but because they're not deemed dangerous, they simply are caught in this cycle of jail, street, jail, streets.
We were talking about Adam Knapp earlier, Marcia's son,
sure,
who died in the auto accident that he caused, but he could have survived. And I wonder, Marcia, do you think about that? That what now you've heard over the years, how many times of mentally ill people committing a crime? Often they die in the process of it, but then if they don't, they're often adjudicated.
Right. And just because they're not saying they're going to kill someone or kill themselves doesn't make them a danger. My son wasn't sleeping. And for him to get behind a car, which he did without me, you know, knowing, that's a danger to him and to anyone else. And that's what, you know, that's what happened.
You know, my son, I took him to the emergency room just like the doctor was talking about, and he had told me that he was thinking about killing himself. He was clearly psychotic, but it's just like the doctor said a few minutes ago. Decisions are made now because of a lack of services, a lack of beds. They're made on determining not on how sick the person is, not how dangerous they are, but really made on whether they're suicidal or imminently dangerous, because it's a triage system. And because my son knew who the President of the United States was, and because he knew that crying over spilt milk, he could explain that, he was deemed not, and because he said, oh, I'm not going to hurt anyone, that was good enough to send him out the door. And 48 hours later, he broke into a stranger's house to take a bubble bath. And you know, even that was not considered dangerous enough. That's why he was going to be taken to jail rather than treatment.
You know, I imagine that Miami-Dade County jail keepers let you in because they know this is a problem.
The leading advocates for changing our system are people like in Ohio, Chief Justice Eve Stratton. They're coming out of law enforcement because, one, they realize these people don't belong in jails. Two, they're not getting any better in jails. And three, it's all about the money. Trying to take care of people in the criminal justice system is an expensive and it's a wasteful use of tax money. They want them out. You had a sheriff in Ohio who absolutely refused to let people come into jail with mental illness because he said they belong in treatment, and he caused quite a stir out there.
Leslie from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Hello. I am a mother of a son who was killed on I-270 on December 20th of 2011, and I just want to share that we do not have the supports that are needed for people with mental illness.
Now, your son, I'm sorry, Leslie, your son was walking on 270 and he was struck. He was a pedestrian.
That's correct.
He shouldn't have been there.
He should not have been there, mm-hmm. but he was there because of his mental illness.
Right.
We knew that he was a danger to himself and possibly others. We had called the police to see if they could take him in to get him pink slipped. We called NetCare. The NetCare intake person came to our house. Our son came over. They came to our house and interviewed him. And they said that they could not take him, could not recommend that he be pink slipped, and that night he was killed. And I want to say that I want 2 points here. He had inadequate medical treatment for his diagnosis. He was being treated at Southeast Mental Health. He had not been in for medication since May. I conveyed that information as often and as loudly as I could to his case manager, and that was not, that didn't help. I also feel that parents or people in the community need to be able to say say that someone they care about is possibly suicidal or may possibly harm someone else and have that heeded.
Yeah, but you know, the problem is, and we were talking about it earlier, Leslie, and thank you very much for your call, is that it doesn't matter how much you know. They're not necessarily listening to you, right, Marcia?
Correct.
You were very angry at the time, and I imagine you probably still are about that, but Pete Early, has much changed?
No. Of course, the problem here is a fundamental civil rights issue. What we know that we want to protect people. We don't want people thrown into what used to be state hospitals and have an ice pick stuck up under their eye and their brain scrambled and say, hey, you know, guess what? You got a lobotomy, you're cured. By the same token, we've gone so far in waiting for someone to become dangerous, and we don't listen. Leslie's point is excellent. We don't listen to the people who know them best. There's an attitude of, oh, you're just trying to dump your problem on us. And instead of being seen as partners, we're seen as the enemy, and that's wrong.
Leslie, we're so sorry for your loss, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Anne in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
This is Anne?
Yep.
This is Anne. Yes, I live here in Columbus, and my daughter's 28, and she's been diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 17, and it's been a long struggle, and we've gone through all kinds of things. But when she was first diagnosed, she went into Walmart and did some shoplifting, and then she was arrested, and she was in and out of hospitals. But it was pretty much after she served time right here in Franklin County that she finally got the help that she really needed.
When she was sentenced, did they know she was mentally ill?
Oh, yes. And she was on a whole array of different medications. And when she was in there for about, I think it was like almost 2 months, they took her off everything. She had absolutely no medication while she was in Franklin County.
Hmm.
And that's not uncommon. What happens is a lot of times someone will be picked up for like shoplifting, and they'll go into a jail setting. And they'll either get different medications or no medications. And then they'll become psychotic, and they'll spit at an officer, or they'll take a swing at an officer. And then they'll end up with a felony charge, and they get trapped into the whole system. If I may, Ann,
yes.
Ohio used to be a real leader when it came to mental health. And one of the reasons was because you developed mental health courts. And they take people like my son, who clearly got in trouble because of a mental illness, and they say, if you want to come through the mental health court, we will keep you out of the other system. But part of being in a mental health court is then you are funneled into treatment, and you get the kind of care. It's kind of ironic, but because of the lack of community care, we've turned to the criminal justice system to save us. And in some states, like Alabama, you'll have people say, oh, the best thing that can happen to you is you get arrested. Then you'll get help. Well, that's wrong.
You said that Ohio used to be a leader. Now, there still are some jurisdictions. There are jurisdictions with mental health courts, but it's not uniform.
That's correct. And also, I'm basing that on, for instance, a few months ago, the Columbus Dispatch did a big story, and you've had budget cutbacks,
right,
like everybody has. But the fundamental problem is it's two things. One, we have this tremendous squeeze, and this is happening nationally, where mental health gets cut. Why? Because they don't have a PAC. They aren't giving money to politicians. They're an easy target, and people are afraid of stigma. They don't want to speak out. So it's not a frontline issue. So politicians always cut mental health services. And secondly, because we don't have adequate community mental health services, that creates problems when it comes to, like, the doctor. I was very impressed that he was candid enough to say this, where it's a triage system, where you have somebody like my son who comes in who's clearly psychotic, and then the dad says, hey, he's thinking suicide. Well, has he cut himself? Has he actually done anything? Well, we have to really wait until he does that.
Anne, thank you so much, and good luck.
All right, thank you.
Take care. Marcia Knapp, was Adam ever incarcerated? Was he ever in the criminal justice system?
No, he was not. But his last episode that he had, he wound up in New York State. He was in a hospital for 4 weeks because of court jurisdiction. He was not medicated properly and released after that 4 weeks. He was home that night and tried to commit suicide. So he was in one hospital in Columbus for 1 week, home not even overnight, taken back to another hospital for a week. And trying to commit suicide, they tried to tell me that he was okay that quickly after not being properly medicated. It was very frustrating.
Now, Marcia, compared to a lot of people, you had resources.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we had good medical coverage and, I mean, just a lot of support.
Right. And Pete Early, to what extent does that affect someone's ability to survive?
Oh, it's huge. If you don't have an advocate helping someone, then the chances of them making it through our system are just really, really awful. It helps to have great insurance. It helps to have other access to people who you can pull strings. You have to get in there and you have to fight. You know, I was in Philadelphia. Two people came up crying after I'd given a speech, and they said to me, we're both psychiatrists, and we couldn't save our son. These are horrible illnesses. And, you know, the doctor who was just on your show said that it took him, and he knows the system, a decade to get help for someone. This is the kind of stuff we're facing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Pete Early. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pete Early is a journalist and mental health advocate. He's the author of the 2007 Pulitzer Prize finalist, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. And Marcia Knapp, she's the mother of a mentally ill son, Adam Knapp, the late Adam Knapp. Thanks so much for joining us today, Marcia. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about adult mental illness and from the point of view of the criminal justice system. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In the new book, The Undead, science writer Dick Teresi examines how advanced medical technology is blurring the line between life and death. One example relates to the process of organ donation. We'll also talk with organ transplant surgeon Dr. Richard Freeman, professor and chair of the Dartmouth Medical School Department of Surgery. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon. In the first hour of the program, climbing Mount Everest and in the environmental effects of tourism on Everest. And then in the second hour, Tech Tuesday, social media fundraising for a cause, consumerism and gadgetry. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
A basic membership to 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and helps keep the news you enjoy on the air. Make your first-time gift or renew your basic membership and get the WOSU member card, too. Just visit WOSU.org. And at 68 degrees with some sunshine, expect sunny skies today with a slight chance of a thunderstorm and a high of 80. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Music. Today on All Sides, we're talking about the struggles of mentally ill adults and their families to cope with the current mental health care system. Also, the criminal justice system. We heard that John W. Mallett, he's the suspect in the downtown stabbings last week, is mentally ill and off his medication. His father and aunt said they tried to get him help, but now it's too late. Still with us is Marcia Knapp, the mother of the late Adam Knapp. He was mentally ill, diagnosed with schizophrenia. Marcia, once again, thanks for staying with us.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Mike Miller. He's a criminal law attorney with Kegler, Brown, Hill & Ritter here in Columbus. Mike was Franklin County's elected prosecuting attorney for 17 years before going into private criminal law practice. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You were one of the attorneys who defended Charles A. McCoy Jr., the so-called highway shooter from 2003. He also suffered from severe mental illness, and his family also struggled to help him. He was 29 years old when he pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter and manslaughter and 10 other charges in that series of Ohio highway shootings. Mike, what was your first, as a criminal defense lawyer, what was your first impression of him? What were you thinking about how you would prepare a case to defend him?
Well, when I first met Charles, he was incarcerated. He'd been here, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 days when I brought him back from Las Vegas. And I went down to meet with him, and you know, you don't have to be an expert to discern immediately that there was something wrong. That Charles just wasn't a normal person. That he had problems. And once we got into it, it was very clear it wasn't something that we were making up. We had, I believe, Ann, it was over 8 years of records where Charles had been treated for paranoid schizophrenia, and you know, it was obviously nobody was making this up. This, I remember, a young man, his parents came home from a movie or something, and he was sitting in his rec room, and all the paneling was down from the walls when his mom and dad came in from the movie, and they said, "Charles, you know, what on earth is going on?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm looking for cameras. I know people are spying on me." And that's when they put two to two together, and his mom had said that, you know, times she'd go out for a night and see dust on her clothes in the closet and couldn't figure out how it got there. And of course, Charles is going up through the ceiling, taking the false ceiling out and looking for cameras and so on. And the next day they made an appointment and took him in, and he'd never been a problem, was never any criminal history. And 8 years they treated him, and he'd get on and off his meds, which I think is somewhat typical for people with that type of an illness, which then culminated in the incident.
How important was it? Well, there were two trials. One was the first ended in a mistrial. In that case, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity?
He did. And it was a hung jury. The jury was out, as I remember, and I think either 3 or 4 nights, a long time. And it was they were splintered quite a bit. I think it was 8-4. And no movement at all. And at the end of that period of time, the judge declared him to be you know, a hung jury and dismissed it. We had to set it again. And then the question is, you know, what do you do for the second step? And you know, in Ohio, when I first started practicing years and years ago, not guilty by reason of insanity, there were two criteria that you looked at. Number one, an irresistible impulse. Somebody could not stop from doing an act, and if you could show that by preponderance of the evidence, the person was adjudicated not guilty by reason of insanity. But the legislature took that out of the law probably maybe sometime around the mid-80s or something, and made it simply a right versus wrong. If you know what you're doing is wrong, then you're sane. It's just that simple. And we faced another retrial, and the charges against Charles initially was a death penalty. And then for the second trial, they dropped the death penalty, but it was still life imprisonment. And there were so many shootings involved. Each shooting carried an additional 3 years. So if there were 11 shootings, perhaps he were convicted of those, he'd get 33 years for that with no good time before he was sentenced for the homicide or anything. And the sentence would really be, he'd be in clearly for the rest of his life. Even had we gotten a not guilty by reason of insanity, he wouldn't have been released. He'd go into a mental facility until such time, if ever, that they thought he would be free to leave. So we got together and we thought if we could structure something that was acceptable to both sides, it would probably be in the best interest of Charles. And so the second time around, we entered the plea that you've already mentioned. And Charles got a sentence of 27 years in prison.
So when they changed the law to make it simply the difference between right, knowing the difference between right and wrong, right versus wrong, was that something you supported at the time?
Yeah, I did support it at the time, and I'm not sure that I oppose it now. I never thought the irresistible impulse was really a very good thing to have in the law. I thought people tried to really, on the defense side, really take advantage of it. I don't really have a problem with the right versus wrong either. The problem that I have is what we do with people that meet this criteria. As an example, Ann, I think the best thing to say is the prosecution's witness in this, they're a prime psychiatrist who I really had no problems with. Obviously, our psychiatrists split. But I remember his testimony pretty much verbatim. And he arrived at the conclusion that Mr. McCoy was sane because he knew that what he was doing was wrong. And he made that judgment, among other things, that Charles left the jurisdiction and did things like that. And I think a reasonable person, you know, you might argue that. I'm not saying that it was unreasonable, although I disagreed with it. But what he said was, in his opinion, Mr. McCoy was sane. However, without question, through this entire process, he was, and I quote, severely mentally ill, unquote. So we're all in this courtroom with this man's life at stake, or, you know, years and years and years of incarceration, and we may quibble about whether he knew right from wrong, and I don't use quibble lightly, but we all agree from both sides that he is severely mentally ill and has been severely mentally ill for a long time. And yet, he is treated within the system through nobody's fault, the prosecution's fault, the judge's fault, our fault, nobody's fault. That's the law. As if he were perfectly sane and had committed these acts, you know, with a truly evil intent and so on. And the problem I have is how we treat these people. I think most of us would say that no Charles and witness the trial and so on, if we could make sure he'd take his medicine, he'd never be a threat to anybody. And I think people on the other side of this feel the same way as I do, but the question is, can you get somebody to force them to take their medicine?
614-292-8513. You can call that number if you want to join the conversation. My guest, still with us in the studio, Marcia Knapp, mother of the late Adam Knapp, who was diagnosed as with schizophrenia. Also with us, Mike Miller. He was a defense attorney for Charles McCoy Jr. He was the highway shooter in 2003. You can give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Marcia, in his statement apologizing to victims, Charles McCoy said he was ashamed by his disease and didn't want to admit that he was mentally ill. I think that out of everything I've read about it, that makes me the saddest.
Yes, and it's very true. My son did not want anyone to know he had this mental illness. He worked for the last 5 years. No one he worked with knew he had any type of illness. As long as he stayed on medication, he was quite normal.
Mike Miller, in 1982, John Hinckley was acquitted by reason of insanity in his attempted assassination of Ronald President Reagan. They used the insanity defense. It provoked outrage around the country and many changes. Was that what was associated with the right versus wrong change in Ohio law?
I think that's probably right. Yes, you're absolutely right. The Hinckley case really had a lot of problems. And you know, I think a lot of people were not happy with the insanity defense in the criminal justice system even before then. But I believe that was sort of the catalyst that probably led to the change in Ohio.
We've also coupled it with the deinstitutionalization. Now, we have a whole generation of people out there who've really never been institutionalized for any length of time because there just aren't the facilities and the system isn't set up that way. Any sense about a proliferation of mental illness related crimes in the system now?
Well, I'm not sure, Anne. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to have a certain percentage of these illnesses, because they're going to reflect the percentage of the population that suffers from these diseases and through no fault of their own, and either for lack of getting treatment, or in many cases they have the treatment, but they don't take the drugs. And what I've been able to ascertain about this, and I, unlike your guest, I'm certainly not an expert on it, but it seems that this not taking the drugs is a part of the disease. For like Marcia said, or I think it was true with Charles too, that they don't want to admit these things and they want to think that they're normal like everybody else, and they don't take the medicine for a day or two or 3 days or a week, and they seem to be all right. And it's kind of built up in them. And then as it slowly ebbs out, you know, after 3 weeks or something, they don't have anything, and they do these bizarre acts. Now, fortunately, most of them don't do violent type acts. And as unfortunately happened here a week or so ago,
yeah.
And as my client did years ago. But still, had they stayed on their medicine, they wouldn't have done anything bizarre, because for the most part, they are fairly normal if they take it. But they don't want to take it because they want to be like everybody else.
You know, I think it was Pete Earle brought up the Ohio sheriff, or I'm sorry, Pete Early, who brought up the Ohio sheriff who has refused to take any more mentally ill prisoners into his jail. He said, this is not what we're set up to do. It's just not right to do it that way. You know, you were a county prosecutor for a while. Were you getting any pushback at all back in those days from people saying, you got to quit sending us these people?
No, I don't think we got a lot of pushback, but what we tried to do was look at the cases, and if you had something that was clearly, to me anyway, just bizarre, incredible behavior that served no rhyme or reason, many times we would work something out with a defense attorney where we would, in essence, stipulate a finding of not guilty by insanity and have them shipped directly to mental facilities and out of the prison system. I know we didn't do it a lot, but I suppose the 7 years I was prosecutor, you know, I would think we probably did that, 10, 12 times maybe. You know, once every year and a half, once every 2 years, something like that. A case would come up that we were all convinced, you could just look at it and know, hey, wait a minute, this is not a criminal. This is not an evil person out there doing something to try and, you know, rationally gain something from somebody else. This person has got mental problems, and we need to get them help, and this is the way to do it. So I don't remember a lot of pushback.
Do you feel like people like Charles McCoy or the fellow who's been the suspect in the stabbings in the last week or so, are there enough people out there like you, experienced attorneys, who know how to handle these kinds of cases and give them the best shot?
Well, I don't know. I wonder if we really even need to get to that, and it just seems, I don't know about this case that just happened down here, but mm-hmm. but if it appears what it is, just some absolute bizarre, no rhyme or reason, a history of this man having all these problems, it seems to me what we really need, instead of at least to start with the attorneys, we need something in the legislature, something in the law, where we can get these people in for long-term mental health care and avoid the criminal justice system. And, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to do. Like, in my case, we had a lady, perfectly innocent lady, wonderful lady, simply going shopping one beautiful weekend day, as I recall, and driving down a freeway, gets shot and killed. And, the tragedy of that and people becoming so irate, and rightly so, it's sometimes difficult to deal with. Is there some way we can handle this, except taking this young man and at the time either executing him or putting him in prison for the rest of his life? And those are difficult steps. You know, I think if somebody had not been killed, we might have been able to work something out in this matter. But sometimes the offenses are so terrible that that door is sort of shut to you.
Marcia Knapp, is Adam, when he decided to go the wrong way down that expressway, killed somebody in the process, what was your experience with that family and how they reacted to it?
We have not spoken to them yet. We will be going out to the state of Washington this summer, and I really hope to confront them. But I think the authorities explained to them the situation of Adam to maybe make it a little bit easier. I don't know. I know that we were crushed at the thought that someone else died due to his illness. And that's just something, you know, we still are working on.
As far as the getting them to take their medication thing that Mike Miller was talking about earlier, that's very common. And I don't know if it was Mike or who said it's like part of the illness.
It certainly is. And Adam was a real health fanatic, and he did not like the changes, even though they were minor, didn't like the changes. So he kept thinking he'd beat it himself without the medication.
Susan, you're on the air. We're running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in.
So, oh, am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, great. Well, I would like to see a move away from viewing these problems as a medical illness and treating them with drugs, because in other countries they're treating things that are labeled as schizophrenia without drugs and having a lot better success. For instance, in Finland, in an area of Finland, they've reduced the rate of schizophrenia diagnoses by 90%. And they don't even think of it as an illness. They think that psychosis is caused by severely frayed social relationships, and they work on repairing those relationships.
And so in some cases, that could be helpful. In some cases, is that Marcia Knapp something you feel confident about would have been helpful for Adam?
Definitely not, because he was a very social person, loved people. And so I can't say that he had any problems or issues in that aspect.
Thanks, Susan, for your call. We appreciate it. Mike Miller, going forward, you're saying things should change.
Well, I'd like to. I still go and visit Charles about once a year, and I look at him, Ann, and I don't feel that he's a criminal. I know he's done a terrible act, and I know he's harmed a lot of people because of his acts, but I think they were caused by his mental problems and not because he's a bad human being. It saddens me that to the system and all of us, it's nobody's fault.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seemed to have been able to come up with a solution to this problem. And as much as I don't think the answer is putting Charles or people like him in jail for the rest of his life, I also don't think you just ought to let him go and walk the streets and hope it doesn't happen again. You can't do that either. And there's got to be something that we can meet halfway in between to solve or at least alleviate this situation.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mike Miller, he's a defense attorney and also former Franklin County prosecutor. Marcia Knapp, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Marcia Knapp with her husband, Dan Knapp, parents of Adam Knapp, the late Adam Knapp, who had schizophrenia. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at wosu.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.